Okay, this is an interview for Contact Magazine with Mr. Lasang Sering and Ben. I am asking the questions. My name is Ben Bird. All right, Lasang, so you were born in Tibet. Tell us about your early life in Tibet and how you ended up coming into India.
Well, life in Tibet, I was very young, very few memories.
Yeah.
But from what little I remember, my father, my late father, was a Tantric Lama from Eastern Tibet, but he had settled in Western Tibet. I was born in Western Tibet, a privileged childhood, where although the invasion had taken place, the Chinese had yet to come to Western Tibet. So my memories of Tibet were a privileged childhood, clear open blue skies, the open spaces, and therefore a life where is something whenever I think of those few years in Tibet, tears come to my eyes. Mm. Something that I miss.
Okay, and then your family came to India. What made the family choose to leave Tibet and come into India?
As I said, my late father was a Tantric Lama, and he had two premonitions. Firstly, of his own early death, and secondly, he feared a national tragedy. Sadly, both came true. And he had already done his pilgrimage of India. For most Tibetans couldn't make it in those days. But for a Tibetan to make a once-in-a-lifetime pilgrimage of India, the land of the Buddha, that was a dream. For us, it was a reality. My late father had brought us to India. We did our pilgrimage, and he passed away at this holy lake called Revulsar. So my father, when people ask me, when did you come? I say, I didn't come to India. He said, no, you two look too old to be born in India. I said, I was not born in India. Well, my parents brought me here.
So how old were you at that time when you came?
Seven.
7 years old, okay. And your parents, then when did you settle? You settled in Dharamshala?
No, then because my father passed away, this memory, despite my stroke and those many years, because my father was a lama, he was cremated on the banks of this holy lake. Mm. And the huge funeral pyre, my late mother performing the prostrations, this image is engraved in my mind. While we were observing those long 49-day prayers after his death, then the other refugees came. My late mother, with us three children to look after, had joined. Most early Tibetans, you will know, first of all, the Indian plains were a little too hot for us. We did not have skills for the Indian job market. Most early Tibetans were employed as construction laborers, road laborers. And while I was in this road labor camp in Manali, after His Holiness settled in Dharamsala in 1960, some officials came there, picked us up. My eldest brother, she said, mother is alone, I will look after her. I still feel grateful for that. My elder brother and I were among the other children brought here to what was then known as the nursery for Tibetan refugee children. Today, the Tibetan children's village. It is more a children's town.
Okay, so you started off at this nursery, Tibetan nursery, and then how did your schooling progress after
that? From here, I was among the first group to be sent. You will know His Holiness stayed in Mussoorie briefly before moving here. While His Holiness was there, he had started the first Tibetan refugee school. So we were sent to that school. While I was in that school in 1962, some members of an American missionary group called TEAM came to the school, conducted a few IQ tests, and along with another boy and a girl, I was sent to this privileged public school started by the British in 1888 called Weinberg Allen School.
And where was that?
And in the same town.
Okay. Weinberg. And then you were going to go to become a doctor in the United States. That was the plan from your family and also Dalai Lama?
No, the thing about becoming a doctor happened so that when I was in class 8 in school, my English language teacher that year was the headmaster's wife. She had this system of making us write a composition school essay every week. 1 week, the topic was my ambition. And by then, what had happened was earlier that year, I don't remember what issue it was. It was in back issue of Reader's Digest. I had read an article about Tibetan guerrillas fighting in Tibet. And I had made up my mind that I must join. I said, these are the same people who fought when the invasion took place. And there's no information about younger people joining. I said, if younger people don't join, how will the struggle continue? So I made up a new ambition in that school essay to say, I want to be a doctor. The Tibetan, first of all, our hygienic habits are not good enough for the hot climate of India. And also, the Tibetans were facing difficulties from diseases which did not exist in Tibet. So to cut a long story short, I wrote this school essay about wanting to be a doctor. And my sample, everyone, decided Lhasang is going to be a doctor. So when I completed school, they offered me this scholarship to study medicine. But I, as I said, by then I had decided to join the guerrilla force. I refused.
So you had this passion to fight for
freedom.
Freedom. So you went to Mustang with the guerrillas. But then that army was disbanded. What happened at the
what
end
happened
of that?
Was, I was there most of 1973. Early 1974, I was back in Dharamsala because I was supposed to be sent for some special training. While I was here, by then, you know, President Nixon's visit to China in 1972, signing of the Shanghai Communique, although I have not seen this in writing, my feeling is that a part of the secret deal in reaching that agreement with China and the United States was that I think this was a condition the Chinese demanded from the President Nixon, that the CIA would stop helping the Tibetan guerrillas in Mustang. By then, China was putting, that same year, the King of Nepal was hauled up for a meeting with Mao, and we were facing pressure from the government of Nepal, and the media were here to ask His Holiness what he was going to do. I went up to see His Holiness and said, Your Holiness, you must not order, but against all the factors that were there, His Holiness, you know, the situation was so tense, it was felt even a written order would not, you know, the guerrillas could say we don't know. So a verbal taped message was sent there. And where the first message was played, two of my friends, they committed suicide. They could not disobey His Holiness because they could hear His voice on the tape. They could not give up because they had vowed to fight for freedom. Somehow, this is not right. This is not fair. In any way, to cut a long story short, by then, a few others committed suicide. The guerrillas tried to go back to China. No. The government of Nepal forced the Tibetan guerrillas to surrender. That was the end of the active struggle for freedom. And now, we are the most successful refugees. I'm not proud about that. We have failed as freedom fighters. That is my pain, and that is my problem.
So you went to see His Holiness about this guerrilla issue. What did you ask him exactly?
My request to His Holiness was, Your Holiness, please don't get involved. We cannot give up the struggle for freedom, because this is about the life of the nation. A nation not free, you know, that we have no rights. However, His Holiness chose, I believe there were other political pressures on His Holiness. I'm not blaming His Holiness for not being able to stand up to those huge diplomatic political pressures on His Holiness. And yet, somehow, I feel it was not right. And yet, as I said earlier, His Holiness sent that taped message calling on the guerrillas to surrender, and that was the end of our active struggle for freedom.
So speak about your relationship with Jamyang Norbu and just generally the Rangzhen movement in the 1970s and 80s between the Mustang events and the middle way policy announced?
I had heard about Jaimin Nobu before I went into Mustang, because he had already served there for a year. He was back here. And before I personally met him, when I was in Mustang, he, with his better resources, had taken a huge number of books there. I was able to read the books that he had taken up and got some idea about his interest. Many, I have learned a great deal. You know, he was more widely read, more widely traveled. On coming back, I met with Jaimin. By then, he was a member of the Central Executive Committee of Tibetan Youth Congress. Through the 70s, life here in Dharamsala, there was this feeling of purpose. And the first generation educated in exile, like, you know, people like Jaimin, the founders of the Tibetan Youth Congress, Tenzin Kejela, the late Lodi Kyari, Tenzin Namgyela, the late Mr. Sonam Tobgyel, who was the head of the government. There was this feeling of purpose and a sense of unity, which today we lack.
So what was this purpose that these people had coalesced around? You had a common goal.
The common goal of struggling for freedom, that now a new generation educated in exile have begun to graduate from high schools and colleges, that now, although the CIA had stopped helping us, doesn't matter, now the burden is on our shoulders. We have to get into action, because unless we have an active struggle for freedom, there cannot be support. Support cannot precede action. Support can only follow action. And there was this new generation graduating from schools and colleges who were now taking up the responsibility from the older generation. The older generation felt, okay, now this is good. Our responsibility is over. We have a new generation whom we can rely on. We can trust them to continue. So there was this feeling of purpose, this feeling of unity, which today we lack.
And at that time you had this concept, the Mosquito Plan.
No, that plan of mine came later.
When did that come around?
1980, after I went back to Tibet.
1980. Okay, so talk about how you came up with this Mosquito Plan and what that, and your visit to Tibet in 1980.
Yes. So now the Tibetan government facing these deep problems, I believe, although it has, I have not seen this in writing, I believe there was also pressure from the government of India. How long are you going to stay in exile? That India, I believe, under Indira Gandhi, was trying to get into the Security Council. But this was being vetoed by China. So there could have been diplomatic pressures that we ordinary Tibetans don't know about. It's easy to blame the leadership for giving up, but they were facing huge pressures and difficulties. So then, when in 1979, His Holiness sent this first so-called fact-finding delegation to Tibet, I was in Japan. I felt, again, we are being misled by China. I came back and went up to see Holiness. His Holiness would not listen. Then in 1980, when the second and third fact-finding delegation were to go to Tibet, Chetan Bemla was head of the third, the younger sister of His Holiness. She wanted me to take responsibility for TCV, because if anything should happen to her. I said no, because I had decided to go back to Tibet. And when I went back to Tibet, among other things, I saw evidence of Chinese settlers moving into Tibet. And I said, now we're finished. My plans were to stay in Tibet for 2 or 3 years. And anyway, to cut a long story short, when I saw evidence of Chinese settlers moving into Tibet, I called this the Chinese demographic aggression, sending millions upon millions of settlers into Tibet. I called this China's final solution. I cut short my visit. I came back to Dharamsala, requested His Holiness. I said, please appoint me as the head of the government. I said, I cannot achieve freedom in 5 years, but I will show a clear way forward. And this idea of mine that although we don't have a military solution, the Chinese have more armed men. If you put the PLA, People's Liberation Army, PEP, the so-called People's Armed Police, is another wing of the army. They have more men in arms than the entire population of Tibet. We don't have a diplomatic solution. The powerful nations of the world want to do business with China. So my idea of the what I call the strategy of the mosquito is that, you know, the four nations under Chinese rule, not only Tibetans, Eastern Turkestan, Southern Mongolia, Manchuria, for us to get together and don't do action in your own country, because there can be retaliation. But for one member from every family of our four nations to move into China, I just call them mosquitoes. If you have a big, powerful man with fancy guns, locked in a room full of mosquitoes. Machine guns are useless against mosquitoes. China may be having nuclear weapons. You can't use a nuclear weapon against somebody in your own city. Now, what are these mosquitoes going to do? Target communications and power supply. For a girl to cut a telephone wire, would you really need a UN resolution? For a young man, throw an iron rod across high tension wires. A factory without power, what will they produce? If there's no power for a factory in Shanghai, who do they arrest in Tibet? If telephones in Beijing are not working, who do they arrest in Mongolia? And we do these actions, finally, without any word as to who's doing it. I have been bitten by many mosquitoes, but none have left a visiting card. Now, there's some things to do. You do them. Don't talk about them. Peace is popular to talk about. You talk about peace in the West. There's some things to be done. You do them inside China. Don't talk about them.
And what was the reaction to this plan when you told the other Tibetans?
Well, His Holiness, all I could do was to request His Holiness not to intervene. He decided to intervene. Thereafter, I had no choice. He made his decision to send these fact-finding delegations to Tibet. He made his decision to announce that so-called five-point peace proposal and the Strasbourg Statement, to give up on freedom. And, you know, we are talking about negotiations with China. It takes two to shake hands. The Tibetan leadership has been extending its hand since 1979. No shake hands. The Chinese have no need to shake the hands of helpless refugees. They want Tibet. They don't want smelly Tibetans. They have already too many of their own people. And the number of Chinese in Tibet is increasing every day. The number of Tibetans is decreasing.
So you famously decided to oppose His Holiness's Midway policy on the day it was announced.
On that same day, I was also in Europe at the time.
Okay.
I had spent the morning in Geneva trying to get access to the various diplomatic, the United Nations, I just call it the United Governments. Tibetans, we are a nation, we don't have membership there. I came back to Zurich, the office of Tibet, because His Holiness had announced this policy 5:30 or so, they were still working. And somebody said, come here quickly, the Daily Telegraph in London want to talk to you. I said, about what? He said, about this new policy that the Dalai Lama has announced. I said, but I haven't even seen it. Somebody gave me a copy before I had given it one quick reading. The telephone call from the Daily Telegraph came through. And in that telephonic interview, I stated clearly and firmly that this is not acceptable. That freedom is the life force of a nation. You cannot give up one life when you're dead.
And what was the response to that from the Tibetan community, from the other members of the CTA, etc.?
Well, from the older generation, that anybody questioning His Holiness, they were shocked, dismayed, disappointed. And I believe there were even campaigns to sign up volunteers to eliminate me. But in general, among the thinking public, especially among the younger generation, one clear evidence that there was support for me was that, you know, even the government of India offering me security, because there was this threat on my life. And also within the Youth Congress, in 1989, when I was up for re-election, I was re-elected with 89.9% of the votes, a bigger majority than the first time. First election, I was up against a sitting president, so my victory was with a smaller majority. But the very fact that I was re-elected, and not only re-elected, but with a bigger majority, showed that there was public sympathy for my position. But it's not the question of the Tibetans in exile. My view is that the people inside Tibet are voting for freedom with their lives.
Self-immolation.
And this is the vote that I respect.
Through the self-immolations, you mean?
Yes. Yeah. And even the number of people in prison. When I was in the Youth Congress, we received information from Tibet that when Tibetans take part in these political pro-independence demonstrations, now they no longer have this form. But in those early years, I believe the China's occupation forces in Tibet had a form for Tibetans to sign to say, I was misled, I don't believe in Tibetan freedom, and they could get out of prison, or they were not arrested, or they could even get a job, get interest-free loans to start a business. People inside Tibet are voting for freedom with their lives, and this is the vote that I respect.
So, talk about the nature of independence in this globalized world where there are these big superpowers like the US and China. How can a small nation or a less powerful nation acquire independence?
Well, the fact of His Holiness, the Tibetan leadership, giving up on the struggle for freedom, I believe there may have been a number of pressures on them. My view was that we should not give up on the struggle for freedom, that freedom is the life force of a nation, and a nation not free is a nation that is dead. And it's not about winning or losing, it's about truth and justice. To that extent, my view was that unless we have an active struggle for freedom, there cannot be support. Support cannot precede action. Support can only follow action. And I gave my own personal example. After completing high school, I was offered a scholarship to study medicine in the United States. My sponsors were millionaires. When I refused, they could not do anything. So also today, when we refuse to struggle for freedom, there cannot be any support.
Okay, so you've written a poem, it's called Thank You, India. You have spent most of your life here, so speak about your feelings towards India as a country.
Well, with regard to India, first of all, not only for our Dharma, our most precious possession is the Dharma, it came to us from India. Even our written script was adapted from an Indian script. And today now, more than the past, when our own homeland is under China's occupation, the government and the people of India has given us a second homeland. They have made it possible where Tibetans in exile, we are able to preserve our own culture and our religion. We enjoy more freedom here than our fellow Tibetans in Tibet. To that extent then, we feel forever indebted to the government and the people of India.
So you've written 5 books of your own poetry, plus yes, you've done a translation of the 6th Dalai Lama's work. Speak about the authors who have inspired you in your writing.
Well, in terms of reading Wordsworth and Tennyson, and also Omar Khayyam. But in terms of non-fiction, like Thomas Paine, Common Sense was a great inspiration. Charles Dickens and Hardy. And also, at a political level, Dee Brown, which is Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. So these were books that gave me a sense of purpose. And yet from my own writing, expressing myself in verse, like the local JJI exile brothers. Verse has this advantage of being set into tune, so you reach a wider audience.
And you've got a new book coming out. You've got a new book ready to go.
Yes, now most people will know that I was the first person to say no to the so-called current middleway policy to His Holiness. Before that, after graduating from school, in order to join the Tibetan Guerrillas in Mustang, I had said no to a scholarship to study medicine in America. Later on, I said no to His Holiness to serve as his private secretary. And in short, I had said no to His Holiness on 5 major issues. But then it was not just me saying no to His Holiness. I had also offered some suggestions. His Holiness did not accept. There we are 5 each. So I have written this new book of saying no to His Holiness, also His Holiness saying no to me. And then on the subject of no, also 5 other no's in my life. The last no, saying no to $1 million offered by the Mongolian and Tibetan Affairs Taiwan in Taiwan. They wanted me to work for them. I said no.
What did they want you to do for them?
I did not accept the offer of $1 million, so I did not come to know what was there.
Okay. Okay, and what's the title of your new book?
It's called No, Your Holiness, No. Saying No to His Holiness, the Dalai Lama.
That's the working title?
Yes.
Okay. And when will it be published?
Now that the lockdown has been extended, the book is ready. They were supposed to end the lockdown on May 3rd. They said now till 17th. After 17th, I will go down to Delhi and then we'll see what happens.
All right, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you, Lasang.